Hello, and welcome to another intriguing episode of ABI's Unordinary Course podcast. This episode is being graciously sponsored by SRS Aquium. Dealing with complex loan agency challenges? A better loan agency experience exists with SRS Aquium. SRS Aquium delivers unbiased, independent, third-party loan agency services for syndicated and bilateral loans in the United States and Europe. With extensive experience in distressed and restructuring facilities, insolvencies, and more, the experts at SRS Aquium approach every situation with creativity and a commitment to providing the solution that best fits your deal. Offerings include administrative agent, collateral agent, successor agent, sub-agent, and escrow agent services. It's loan agency at the speed of your deal. Ready to learn more about how SRS Aquium delivers a superior loan agency experience? Find the details at srsaquium.com. Let me spell that address out. That's srsaquium.com. Now let me hand this episode over to our host, Lee Packia. Go ahead, Lee.
Hi folks, Lee Packia from ICR here, and welcome to Unordinary Course, where we unpack emerging trends and current events to figure out what it all means for the restructuring community and the clients we serve. Today, we're talking about what happens when the old comfortable macro backdrop for distressed work is gone. Instead of assuming stable energy, predictable supply chains, cooperative demographics, and reliable commodity plumbing, boards and management teams are now making decisions in a world where those foundations are starting to shift under their feet in real time. The question for our world is simple. How do you underwrite distress when the entire system is undergoing structural change, not just another cycle? To help us sort through it, I'm thrilled to say we have a special guest today, Daniel Gallagher. Daniel spent several decades inside Wall Street, including senior roles in the wealth advisory businesses at Morgan Stanley and UBS, before founding Process for Growth, where he works with financial advisors and investors. He's also the creator of All Things Financial, a video blog of sorts, which I have found to be just indispensable in helping digest today's news flow. You can find it on YouTube, TikTok, and Substack, where he posts near-daily macro analysis built around what he calls the five factors, a framework for how countries, boards, capital allocators, maybe management teams are going to make decisions over the next 10, 15, and 20 years. Daniel, great to have you on the show. I'm so looking forward to this.
Well, thank you very much, Lee. I'm looking forward to this myself.
So wanted to start off at the top with a little bit of background, just to get to know you better and understand how you're coming at this. Tell me, where did you grow up?
Wrong question. My father was one of the, DuPont had the first in-house consulting team, and the number 10 man, the gopher, was my father. And they were internal consultants. And obviously, this became a Harvard business study, and this team then were all the banks. In those days, there's no corporate paper, so all the banks hired the people like my father, and they would put him into a company and say, there's the president, there's Dan, you talk to Dan, don't listen to the president. And we would move around the country. So I have moved more than most military brats. We had seven kids. But we moved all over the country until finally they started to form management consulting firms. And my father then became one of the seven wizards at Proudfoot. So we moved everywhere in this country. There's very few places I have not lived.
You know, I'm really glad I asked that question at the top, because I did not know that answer ahead of time. You know, sometimes I come into these with an understanding of questions I'm going to ask and the answers I'm going to get back. I had no idea that you come from that kind of background, but looking at your content, I kind of see it now. I understand kind of the consultant's framing on top of the financial, economic, and political analysis that you're dispensing. That is absolutely fascinating. So let's move to your core idea here. When you talk on your show about the five factors, can you help take the audience through what they are and why do you think This has gone from background macro noise to first order drivers of corporate and capital structure outcomes. Why, in other words, is this framing so important in your view?
Okay. Well, let's start at the beginning. And unfortunately, we're experiencing what I thought was going to happen as we speak. Okay. So look, it became evident 3 years ago that our ability to control the seas like we did since 1945. So basically from when we signed on with the Bretton Woods all the way until 2019, I believe that was the American empire. And we were an empire. We were a naval and an air force empire. We are not a land empire. Now, when you look at Russia, they're a land empire, okay? Or were. So what it is that if this global security net would no longer existed, okay? And you have to think how powerful this net was. If you look at the three countries that made the best of our Americana, Pax Americana, I would argue they were Germany, they were Japan, and they were China. Now, two of those countries, we wouldn't allow them to build arms, and China couldn't afford to build arms. So these people became great exporters under the umbrella of the U.S. Navy. And even though we considered them quote-unquote enemies, we still traded, everyone traded with everybody. So thereby, under that system, we started to build global systems. So the first question I asked myself, well, so then I said, if this security goes away, how will an individual country, and I would encourage people, do not think of America and China. Think of, let's say, Austria or Finland, someone like that, okay? How is that PM, that dictator, that whoever we have, president, how is he going to make his decisions if there is no longer a global naval umbrella protecting everybody in the world? And I came up with five factors. I said, they're going to have to understand, are they food sufficient? Are they energy sufficient? What's your technology? What's your demographics? And are you easy to attack? As I said in my video yesterday, a throwaway for the first 3 years was, are you easy to attack? People actually ask me, why do you have that in there? No one's asking that anymore. Okay. So these five factors are what people are going to make their decisions on if and when the global system starts breaking down. So then we said, okay, so what global system did we build in the last 70, 80 years? And I came up with four off the bat: our food system, our energy system, our technology system, and what we call UCI, underwater critical infrastructure. They were the four we started with. Since that time, as I said, this is an iterative process. We have added on top REM, rare earth minerals, and magnets, because they are totally separate. They're done processed differently and so forth. So we now have six global systems that could break. Now let's go look at them. Do you think that our technology, global technology system, has broken over the last 3 years? Totally, right? We got bans, we got everything, right? What about our energy system? Is that broken? I would say totally broken. Then you look at food. Here's the thing that literally scares me, okay? 100 years ago, the average piece of food off your table came within 10 miles of your home. Today, it's almost 1,100 miles. We have a global food system, and it's going to break, and it's going to break this summer. When you look at UCI, what's going on? You got the Black Sea. You got Sri Lanka. By the way, I think Sri Lanka is one of the most interesting places in the world at this moment. And I can show you how that is, but to the five factors. But all these four things, REM, totally broken. totally broken. It's going to take us 15 to 20 years to get rare earth minerals up and running in America in tens and tens and tens of billions of dollars. Okay?
Yeah.
So all these systems break. Then you sit there and say, how are people going to make their decisions? Well, look at Takachi. Takachi just went to America, met with Trump, walked out of the meeting and turned around and called Iran and said, we'll buy your oil and yuan. She made an economic decision. So think about what happened under the American umbrella. Every decision made in the world was a political decision, not economic. Economics didn't matter. Think about our world. Our world was, where is it? How much is the shipping? And when can I get it here? That's it.
Yeah.
We had a hub in... Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to jump in here because, I mean, you're painting a really interesting picture. And no doubt, supply chains are stressed and inflation remains sticky. I mean, I spent a fair amount of this morning watching Bloomberg and going through today's CPI print. And it sure looks we're embarking on, you know, a second wave of inflation here. But when you look at this kind of thing, you're seeming to say that this isn't so much cyclical pain, but it's a structural impairment. And in your view, what changed in the last what changed in the last decade to convince you that we're dealing with a structural regime shift? It's not all just about the news flow of the last 12 months.
No.
Or is it?
This was over, I'll say, 2015. And that's when our Navy is stretched. So let's take, you know, I'm an older guy, okay? Bretton Woods, when we signed the Bretton Woods Agreement, we had 1,250 ships. Today, we have 256, okay? Remember when Ronald Reagan ran for president the first time? You know what he ran on? We're going to build back to 600 ships, all right? So we don't have the ships, the manpower, the capacity. We can't build new ships. We can't do anything. I did a video about 2.5 years ago on the gentleman who is the, he was the guy who writes force projection for the U.S. Navy, all right? That's who he is, commander, all right?
Uh-huh.
And when you read his report, it was like, it's all over. He was saying, this is the Navy, guy telling the Navy, we need to pull back to the Western hemisphere, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone looked about 3 or 4 months ago, I did a video on it then. We came out with our new, strategy for the next 20 years. And basically it was pull out of Europe, pull out of the Middle East, pull out of Southeast Asia, and dominate the Western Hemisphere because that's all we have the military for, okay? So what has happened is since we can't do the military, things happen, and there are data points. Like the first data point that really got me watching this, believe it or not, were the pirates over there in the Middle East. I'm a historian. I read history every day. One of the favorite subjects is pirates. Do you ever read why pirates existed? It's because we couldn't control the seas. Once we controlled the seas, there were no more pirates. We don't control the seas. That's why they're pirates. And that's why countries can't count on us. So when you think of these countries that were able to trade around the world under us, under our largesse, we're the ones that allowed them to do it. We didn't charge them for anything. So now that's over.
Yeah.
So now when you start looking at each country, you can't count on it. Look what just happened with Canada. We put the 50% tariffs on Canada. On two things, on aluminum and on fertilizer. So our buyers looked around the world and said, hey, we need to get cheaper aluminum. So they gave 20% of their orders to the largest aluminum plant in the world, 9%, which happens to be in Qatar. And 2 weeks ago, Iran took it out. And they're under force majeure for the next 5 years. They can't deliver the aluminum. I don't care about that. I care about the decision-making of the buyers in America, that they thought that it would be better to go to Qatar and get their aluminum than to work with the Canadians or go, let's say, to Norway, which also produces expensive aluminum, but you could get the aluminum in a safer environment. That's the kind of thought process that's missing today in the business world, in the restructuring world. What are you doing? How are you getting things? How do you guarantee them? And we are looking at it all backwards. We say, well, you know, Qatar's sitting on gas, it's cheap, they have cheap aluminum. Not the case, right?
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go next. I mean, countries, national governments are changing their framework for decision-making. You know, can we say that C-suites necessarily are going to have to follow suit? And if so, what does it mean for a board or a credit committee or a management team to start thinking in, you know, five framework type terms rather than just P&L and multiples?
Okay. So this is not dissing you restructuring people, but as you know, it's all about leverage and free cash flow. Okay. That's all you guys think about. So one, leverage is gone. Free cash flow will be king. And so it's going to be a different set of issues that's facing you in the world when you sit there and you break down a company. So
why I wanted to have you on the show, Daniel, by the way.
Okay. So you're going to have to look at the world totally differently. We're starting to work with 50 young executives out of Finland. So I ran Finland through the five factors. It was fascinating. There are good parts and bad parts, challenges. And again, it's not my job to tell you guys, the experts, what to do. So we think of our system as a hub and spoke system. That's what we've done. That is totally gone. All right. So look at, I work with McKinsey, you know, at Morgan Stanley, where I was, I don't know what you want to call it, the colonel on the battlefield, you know, so there's a guy above me, but I ran the Morgan people and I work with my counterpart at McKinsey. So I have one McKinsey. We call this polycentric mutualistic architecture is where we're going. So that'll be the only thing I'll say from about
McKinsey. That's a lot to unpack.
All right. But polycentric is exactly what it is. There's no more one. It's multiple. You have to think of ourselves kind of like a spider web, but each one of those nodes are going to have to be hardened, all right? There's no such thing anymore of saying, you have to start looking at your suppliers differently. You have to look at your suppliers and say, we really need this product. Out of all the products, if we don't have this, it shuts down everything. So what do you do with that supplier? Do you go back to them and say, can we pay for you to hold this for us? Can, you know, what are all the strategies that companies can now have to start employing to make sure they don't get shut down, that they don't go to a country that doesn't allow you to do the things that you want to do, that your country may ban that country? How do you get that done? I have a niece, she was in China making clothes. They made her move everything to Vietnam. She moved it all to Vietnam. The U.S. government came in and then tariffed them, and now she's moving again. So here she's in three moves, but I ran her through the five factors, and I told her, you go to Guadalajara and Monterrey in Mexico, you cut your cost by 45%, and you don't have any more issues, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So every country, every company has to understand what country they're in, what assets are in that country, what do they have and what don't they have, right? And so once we understand that, then you go, what about my neighbor? What about the next guy? So what if you're a small manufacturing firm in Austria and you get parts from Turkey, maybe Russia, Germany, or whatever? How do you manage that so that you can stay in production? It has nothing to do with your free cash flow. It has nothing to do with your leverage at all. It has to do with how your business is designed so that you can do the business, right? And so our decision-making is going to be up front, not in the back, not when something happens to it. I mean, think about, so we had the Hormuz. Within 2 weeks, 8 countries had no oil and gas. Within a month, 20 countries had no oil and gas. Let me ask you a question. The leaders of those countries, how are they thinking about energy today? You see it in the news every day.
Yep, totally differently.
We're going alternatives because it's the only thing they can control. You have 182 countries. You have 18 that ship energy. That means you have 168 have no energy whatsoever. How do those countries man it? And by the way, are you getting your parts from that country and they have no energy? How are they going to make those parts for you? How does that work? Everything has to be put. You have to say, here's my... So when we first did the five factors, it was exactly what we're kind of talking about, kind of geopolitical mixture of economics and everything. And so then one day I asked that we were doing rare earth minerals as a choke point, right? And I said, are there any other choke points in the technology stack for making chips?
Yep. This is my next question. This is exactly where I wanted to go. Go for it.
And it pops up and it goes, Denko Nikko. I'm like, what? Denko? What the hell is Denko Nikko? So we start looking into it. Well, it's a small company in Japan, 3,200 employees. They make, they make some kind of glass product for ASML machines and optics out of Germany and every chip in the world. None of those things can be made without this company, period. End of story. There is no. And the funny thing is, when I looked up Denko Nikko, it was just like 2 months ago. And you know what the first news article was? Every single major CEO of every technology company in the world was flying to their headquarters to bend the knee to beg for the product.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about your analysis. Like, it can get nation states and companies into awfully complicated analyses, and it puts defined problem solving into new weird places. And I'm glad you brought up chips. When you're looking at microchips, they are produced in a part of the world that, is probably likely to get complicated in the next couple of years. And there's not a lot of optionality if you're a business that needs to procure microchips elsewhere. I mean, there's Intel, but beyond that, there's not much. So what are people supposed to do in situations where, like, I get boards and management teams have to start asking themselves different sets of questions. It's going to be a different type of analysis. But what are people in situations who are going to have really constrained optionality? What's going to happen here across the broader economy? Because you talked about choke points before. We could probably sit here all day and come up with a list of potential choke points in the global economy, which is going to deglobalize. I think, in my view and yours, there's probably 100 choke points out there, and we probably only know about 10 of them.
Thousands. I do them all day now. I do them all day. I asked the model, tell me about this. Yesterday, I did the IEA report on REE integration. I did the blade foundry. Do you realize all these blades that you need for turbines and for your windmills and everything? Guess what? There's three companies in the world who make blades. Nobody else. And by the way,
you're talking about blades for wind energy and turbines for jets.
Wind energy and turbine. There's three in the whole world.
Yeah.
That's it. Okay. And guess what? You can't copy this. It tells you why. You cannot copy. It takes years to do. There's Ditto Boeski in Japan. They have less than 30 employees. You cannot make a chip anywhere in the world without this company. They have 30 employees. So when you start going down, so the model allows you to go in and say, tell me about this product. Tell me any choke points. Tell me about this country. So first you do the country, then you do the industry, then you do your product, and then you do your suppliers. And as you build out and understand more and more and more, it becomes apparent. You guys are a hell of a lot smarter than I am. You know how to do restructuring and everything. What I'm telling you is every way that you have restructured for the last 30 years is over. It actually is not even relevant anymore at all.
Boom.
Not at all. You have to be on top of, you know, all our evaluations. We never looked at what we're sitting on top of. And what we're sitting on top of is a system that is totally broken. And by the way, if we rebuild this system, do you think we're going to build a global system? Are we going to build multiple regional systems? Are we going to have regional systems self-contained with all the stuff that they need? Are regional systems then going to negotiate with each other? We have this, you have that, we will share them, right? This is where it's going to be. So you have to be paying attention to your government. Like yesterday, we did the analysis on what the government is investing in. They just put out a NOFO, a notice of funding opportunity for three things, okay, in the rare earth mineral space. Only $69, right? But I was able to go in through the model, and I identified the three companies. So now we know who the three companies are that the government probably is going to give this money and make this work over the next 10 years. So again, how do you look at that? Do you invest in those three companies? Do you make those three companies part of your supply chain? What goes on there?
Yeah.
Your supply chain now, you have to assume it's totally broken, whether it's through tariffs, bans, wars, because guess what? Since we're not there to rule the world and no one would take us on, okay, now you're going to see, and one of the narratives I watch is, are there any, are we starting to see brush fire wars around the world? I don't understand why Thailand and Laos just went at it, but they just went at it for 3 months. We don't talk about it, but they didn't go at it for 80 years. Now they are, because guess what? There's no military force ruling the world anymore.
Yeah. Right?
So we're going to pull back. And when we pull back, that's when it's already happening. We're broken. We're totally broken.
One area where you focus, where I found it really interesting, and it's perhaps an indication of markets not functioning the way they're supposed to, is in your analysis on the silver and commodity market plumbing around future contracts and COMEX and the price of physical. You know, at first glance, that can feel pretty removed from the world of typical Chapter 11 cases. But when you look at companies hedging commodity prices or hungry for physical delivery, the growing difference between physical and paper really matters, I think. Can you talk to us a bit about why this gap between paper pricing and the physical reality in the markets is, first off, so uncommon, and second, so misunderstood?
Okay. I agree with you. I'm not going to say that I understand all the major implications, okay? But basically, the North owns the paper, the South owns the physical. The LME, the NYMEX, the COMEX, right? We control the paper, all right? So when you look in over in Asia, they have the SGE for gold, but that's a physical exchange. It's not a paper exchange, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're seeing here is gold, silver, oil, all the metals, copper, all of them have all broken from their paper anchor. So the paper used to decide what the price was, okay? It's no longer the case. You look at oil, we said oil's $98, okay? And you went to Dubai, they said, no, it's not. It's $140.
Hey,
but when you went to Malaysia, it was $241 two days ago,
mm-hmm.
right? What's the price? Well, if you want the physical, you have to buy it. So I believe, I don't know how it's going to happen, that the COMEX, the NYMEX, the LME, they're done, okay? They're not going to be, they're going away. Now, this is a huge issue for the West because we've been dominating the price with this. Now it's going to go to the owners, the physical owners of the product. Now, the good news for America, anything that we have, like copper, or if we have a silver mine or gold mine or whatever kind of mine that we have to have, lithium mine, all our commodities are going to be worth more money too, okay? But they're not going to be based on paper. So our paper markets are over. We only had 1% or less of the physical. So if people wanted their physical, they had 1% to give out. Well, look at silver. All of a sudden, silver became a high-tech thing. People need silver. And so now it's broken away and it's never going to come back. The problem being is this. We mine about, we mine about 400,000 ounces a year. We're short about 880,000, and the demand is like 700,000 a year now. So we're years away from the paper and the physical coming together. So thereby, I believe paper will go away because we can't last for years. Now you say, why?
Well, Daniel, unpack that for me. Why can't the markets just kind of exist in different realities?
Okay.
The way they seem to be right now. I mean, you know, that hasn't fallen yet, but that doesn't mean.
Okay. So let's use oil. Okay. So you put the oil on the ship. What happens next? One of the five trading houses in the world gives it a letter of credit. Okay.
Uh-huh.
That letter of credit is from 30 days to 180 days, but really it's from the day the ship takes off until the day it ports. They sell the oil, the letter of credit goes away. Okay. Now the trading house takes that letter of credit and they turn around and they go to five European banks and one US bank, Citicorp, and they borrow, they repo it. They take the repo, they take the money. Okay. And they get about 100 cents on the dollar. Now, how much oil is on the sea? Well, trillions of dollars are on the sea. These five trading houses that trade all our commodities, move all our commodities all across the world, is all on borrowed repos. So here's the question. Look what's going on in the Hormuz. We have 3,100 ships in the Hormuz. Now, when a thing happens like happened in the Hormuz, within 24 to 48 hours, all the trading houses pull their LCs. There's no LCs on that oil. No one owns that oil in the Hormuz today. Nobody owns it. And in fact is, there are studies out there, we don't even know what kind of oil is in those ships. We literally do not know. We found this out in whatever it was when 2020, when we went negative because of Cushing. And then we checked out our ships. We didn't even know it was on the ships, okay? So now you're going to restart, and you're going to start sending these ships out. Tell me, Lee, what price are you going to use to give the LC on that you then can go borrow a repo on? You're going to do it at 98, 140, 240? Where do you do it at? And how does that all match up across the world? Where's that oil going when it leaves the Hormuz? Is it going to come? Where's it going? Who's going to pay for it? What's the amount going to be? So the system itself, I don't think people understand that the cascade effect on the oil, financial oil market, we're all looking at helium, naphtha, urea, oil, gas, all this other stuff. Trust me. They're tiny, 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 tiny little things compared to the financial cascade that is going on right now with our five major trading houses and then with our banks. So what happens is the banks now have these $60 billion hole in their balance sheets because of those repos, right? Right now, they have a $60 billion hole in their balance sheets because of those repos. They're not hooked to anything. Right? So, believe it or not, there's only one country out there that has all state-owned banks that do financing for oil. It happens to be China.
Yes.
And when this is all said and done, you're going to find out that China then becomes the major player in the oil market by far, the biggest financer of the oil market.
This is wild, wild stuff. Lots to unpack here. There's a lot of directions we can take this. Daniel, you got to come back on the show. There's like a million different things we could talk about, But, well, you know, you're trying to kind of socialize this framework to practitioners listening, new to this idea. What are the top two or three things they should be doing now to kind of get ready to think, operate, and practice in this emerging reality?
If I was a consulting, firm, a capital allocator, bankruptcy lawyer, or an investment banker, I would, I don't know how many, but at least three supply chain experts I would add to my team. Just a general expert on who understands how, you know, kind of like a military guy. But then you're going to need like a technology expert to understand the technology stacks, where your every single product comes from. Who would ever have guessed that one tiny company in Japan could basically shut down the entire technology world in a day? Just say, we're not shipping anymore. Who would ever thought that? But it exists. And that's a choke point for the entire world.
Yes.
It's nuts. But since we don't have the military umbrella, it's never coming back. It's never coming back. We can't even build ships, for God's sakes. We build one a year, 1.4 ships a year. That's what we built. China builds 100 ships a year. We build 1.4.
Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this week. I want to thank the American Bankruptcy Institute for letting me do this show, and I especially want to thank you, the listener, for making it this far. If you like what you heard, be sure to hit the like or follow button for more. I'm Lee Pacquiao from ICR. See you next time.